Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated February 24th. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Today's front page, top of the fold, Homes and Tech, Seen Mingling on 7,000 Acres, by Amanda Jones Hoyle, from Pittsburgh. Take the golf course and executive homes of Preston Wood Country Club in Cary and mix them in with companies such as those in Research Triangle Park. And there you have it, RTP 2.0. That's what some Chatham County leaders envision one day for Chatham Park, an assemblage of 7,108 acres that Preston Development Company of Cary has been buying up piece by piece over the last 7 years. Tim Smith and Julian Bubba-Rall, partners with Preston Development, say they envision the property, which stretches across much of the undeveloped land between Pittsburgh and the Haw River, would be ideal for mixed-use development one day. You are looking at a long-term project here, Smith says. It'll probably take 20 to 30 years once it gets started. There could be 20,000 housing units out there one day. Preston's Development's biggest financial backer is Cary billionaire Jim Goodnight, co-founder and CEO of SAS, or also known as SAS. In a strategic plan adopted by the Chatham Economic Development Corporation in 2008, the Chatham Park property is identified as an emerging technology park that could one day be a huge employment generator for the county. For Chatham Economic Development Director Diane Reed, development of Chatham Park can't start soon enough. It's not very well defined what exactly the project will be, but we are encouraged by Preston's talk about bringing in employment, generating companies as the core of the project, Reed says. In a marketing video for Chatham Park, Smith and Rawl note that the Research Triangle Park, the biggest employer base for the Triangle, has fewer than 600 of its 7,000 acres available for development. We've got 7,000 acres, so we can offer an alternative to a company if they need 100 acres or 200 acres, or a Google that needs 800 acres right now, Smith said on the video. We don't see us as being competitive with Research Triangle Park, but complementary to them. Smith says the video was produced to help generate interest among investors across the country. Most people don't know much about Chatham County or how close it is to the Triangle, Smith says. But while Smith tells viewers of the video that all the legwork is done, realistically it could be another 2 years before the first bulldozer would start clearing land at Chatham Park. A rezoning request for a 71-acre parcel on Eubanks Road designed for a shopping center was approved in 2008, but no other formal plans for Chatham Park have been filed with Pittsburgh or Chatham County, says Pittsburgh town planner Stuart Bass. A likely first phase of the project would include a retail subdivision, a residential subdivision with some retail elements, he says. Preston Development is also considering building a 30,000-square-foot office building for medical and business professionals on property at the northeast corner of U.S. 64 Bypass and U.S. 15501. UNC Hospital's officials confirmed in late 2010 that they were in negotiations with Chatham Park investors to bring a major facility to Pittsburgh. Next article, BioChrist Sniffs for Partner to Develop Drug. By Jason DeBroom, from Durham. Drug developer BioChrist Pharmaceuticals has a drug candidate ready for final clinical trials, but needs to find a partner with enough cash to pay the way, and that could cost as much as $150 million. Not only does BioChrist face that hurdle, it's also in a bit of a race with another drug developer working on a similar project. The top drug candidate for BioChrist, which moved its headquarters from Birmingham, Alabama to Durham about a year ago, is a product that would fight severe cases of gout. It received good results from early trials, but now the drug must pass Phase 3 human trials, which are large in scope and would cost in the $100 million to $150 million range. BioChrist finished 2011 with less than $60 million in cash and posted an annual operating loss of $50 million. During a conference call, CEO John Stonehouse did not beat around the bush in saying that BioChrist badly needs to find a partner to get the drug to market. Analysts agree. Brett Holly, with Oppenheimer & Company Incorporated, who covers publicly traded BioCryst, says a partnership is critical to advance the drug and maximize its market potential. Unlike a path chosen by some other drug developers in similar circumstances, Stonehouse says he does not want to sell the company to move the product forward. "We have way too much value beyond our gout program," says Stonehouse. Indeed, BioCryst has received $235 million from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services to develop a flu drug and is also developing a drug to fight hepatitis C and one to fight an orphan disease called hereditary angioedema. In fact, Stonehouse hopes to take the HA drug to market without needing a partner. It's a smaller market, but trials would be cheaper and the profits on the back end would go entirely to BioCryst. Recognizing BioCryst does not have much leverage in a deal for the gout drug called BCX4208, Stonehouse says he is willing to accept a deal that would pay BioCryst only if the drug sells well. "We're willing to structure a license agreement that is more back-end loaded," he says. BCX4208 works by lowering uric acid in patients for which allopurinol, an approved drug, is not enough. According to BioCryst market research, about 2.5 million patients would immediately be good candidates because they are not responding to allopurinol alone, according to Robert Bennett, Director of Investor Relations. "That's the base, the low-hanging fruit," Stonehouse says. Uloric, which is different from allopurinol and has the active ingredient febuxostat, sells for about $5 a day. BioCryst has not broken out annual sales projections, but Raul Jesua, Managing Director for Biotechnology Research at Noble Financial Equity Research, has estimated peak annual revenue for BioCryst in the $300 million range after accounting for a partnership. BioCryst looks for a partner. San Diego-based Ardea Biosciences is developing a similar drug, which could compete directly with BCX4208. Ardea has already started a self-funded Phase 3 trial for its gout drug. Bennett said the drugs work in different ways. Now for this week's leading article, Shrinking Homes, Builders Across South Building Smaller Houses, by Amanda Jones Hoyle from Raleigh. Energy-sucking mega-homes, McMansions, if you will, are falling out of favor across the region as buyers become more practical and less aspiring in a post-bubble economy. Not only have average new home prices been dropping, but so has the average size of a new home built in the South. At the market's peak in 2007, the average size of a new home in the South was 2,573 square feet, according to U.S. Census figures. In 2010, the latest year for which figures are available, the average square footage was 2,393, down by 7%. And that has a lot of housing industry analysts wondering how far that number ultimately will fall. Not since the early 1980s, when the U.S. economy was going through a similar economic down cycle, has the average size of a new home declined so precipitously among states in the South. "It is very important that the entire industry keep a close eye on what's going on in the South region," says Paul Embreth, Vice President of Survey and Housing Policy Research at the Washington, D.C.-based National Association of Home Builders. The South region accounts for more than 45% of all construction. The prime factor driving the growing average home size prior to the Great Recession was the increasing number of homes being built at a higher price point. When new home prices in the Triangle reached a peak in 2007, more than 13% of all new homes sold were priced at $500,000 and above. In 2011, just 7% of all new home sales were priced at $500,000 or more, according to housing market research firm Market Opportunity Research Enterprises. Buyer expectations have clearly been tempered in recent years, according to a September survey by real estate research firm Trulia. The survey showed that only 6% of respondents said their ideal home size is more than 3,200 square feet, which is down from 9% of the respondents in a survey the year prior. The value in the Triangle has been to seek value. The trend in the Triangle has been to seek value. Home buyers are looking for as much house as they can get at a base price, says Jay Colvin of Metro Study. He noted that the average base floor plan offered by Triangle Builders has risen slightly since 2010, but the base prices have stayed pretty much the same. Most builders who formerly relied on the construction and sale of high-end homes to drive profits have had to shift to their business model to either build significantly fewer homes each year or switch to smaller homes that have more buyer demand. Richard Gaylord of Richard Gaylord Homes in Raleigh says he used to build 20 to 30 homes a year that were priced between $500,000 and $1 million. When the bottom fell out of the housing market in 2008, he had to shift gears, and quickly. When everything fell off the table, the only things moving with a profit were below $350,000 type thing, Gaylord says. Gaylord still has ownership stakes in lots of several high-end communities across the Triangle, including Rose Hall in Raleigh and Legacy at Jordan Lake in Chapel Hill. But his company's new bread and butter is represented by homes in the $300,000 range in more mid-priced communities like Harrison Place in Fuquay Arena and Highlands at Holly Glen and Holly Springs. Two major factors driving today's housing market and the types of homes being built are price and energy efficiency, says Tim Minton, Executive Vice President of the Home Builders Association of Raleigh-Wake County, a trade group for the home building industry. Clearly, the cost of materials has not gone down, and they are not producing as much because demand has been down. But obviously, the larger the house, the more it will cost to build, Minton says. I'm also hearing a lot of builders talk about high-performance homes, which are very energy efficient. Clearly, square footage is driving some of that, too. Moving to the inside, bankers say grace, right for oversight job, by Lee Weisbecker, from Raleigh. When Ray Grace first went to work for the North Carolina Commissioner of Banks in 1974, Richard Nixon had a month left in office as president, and Winston-Salem-based BB&T had total assets of $300 million. Now, 37 years later, Nixon departed long ago, and BB&T has assets of $165 billion. We have seen a lot of changes, says Grace, 63, who became the state's top banking regulator this month with the departure of Joe Smith. Smith left to monitor the $25 billion national mortgage settlement, ceding to Grace, his chief deputy, the duty of overseeing the commissioner's office and its staff of 100, including 40 examiners. It's an appointment that is winning applause throughout the industry, still in recovery mode and in need of continuity. He has a broad-based support as a career regulator, says Thad Woodard, president of North Carolina Bankers Association. His commitment is to accuracy, compliance, and the stability and security of the state's banks. He is even-handed in all his dealings and has a historical grasp of the industry due to his many years of service. A self-described passionate advocate of community banking, Grace helped start up 95 of them over the years from Manteo to Murphy. He describes as gut-wrenching the months following the financial meltdown and economic downturn when many of those same banks began to experience credit problems. As many as 15 of approximately 100 North Carolina chartered banks continue to operate under high levels of state and federal regulatory supervision due to loan problems. The good news, Grace says, is that a recovery is underway. Things are beginning to stabilize and, to some extent, actually improve, he says. The not-so-good news, Grace adds, is that while larger banks have been sharing in that recovery, many smaller community banks have not. More heavily dependent than the big banks on income from making loans, basement interest rates continue to haunt community bank bottom lines. That's where Grace's wide-ranging knowledge of smaller banks will be beneficial, says Mike Patterson, CEO of Raleigh-based Capstone Commercial Bank. He's known Grace for two decades. Ray knows the community banks, their management teams, and has a good knowledge of their risk profiles, Patterson says. I think he will be able to help them through these difficult times. A Niagara Falls, New York native, Grace joined the Marine Corps after high school, serving a year in Vietnam in 1967-68. Returning home, he enrolled in Niagara University to study commerce, graduated in 1973. A stint at Camp Lejeune had left him well acquainted with North Carolina. A tip from a friend alerted him to an opening for an examiner trainee in the Commissioner of Banks office. Through the years, he filled various examiner positions and ultimately became director of startup applications. Under Smith, who Grace says energized the office by instituting performance-based standards, he became chief deputy in 2010. Nowadays, with authority over the entire organization, he sits behind his desk making mental to-do lists. It's a growing list, in fact, that already includes a modernization of the state's 90-year-old banking statutes, deployment of software packages to make bank and trust examinations easier to do, and a compensation review for a staff that hasn't gotten any raises in 3 years. He admits to once thinking about retirement, but chuckled the notion for a couple of reasons. "I had a will to work," he says, explaining that he wouldn't have known what to do with himself. The second reason has to do with the commissioner's office itself. "This is an agency that can do great good for the state," he says. Next up, Flat Fee Counsel Gains Steam Among Lawyers, by Chris Bagley. From Raleigh. As recession-shocked clients continue to trim expenses, law firms have begun to move away from hourly billing, the practice that has defined corporate legal costs for most of the profession's modern history. While firms and corporate legal departments both expect attorneys' times to remain the primary factor in determining fees for the foreseeable future, flat fees and other alternative arrangements have come to represent as much a quarter of some firms' revenue. Some companies are contracting out entire areas of legal work on a fixed fee basis, $5,000 to $10,000 per case, to defend against lawsuits by employees claiming wrongful termination or discrimination, for example. Clients have been pressuring law firms for years to make legal fees more predictable, and flat fees have been used occasionally as a means to an end, says attorneys on both sides of the table. General Counsel John Boswell of SAS Institute in Cary says outside lawyers generally make sincere efforts to save their clients' money, but adds, law firms that bill by the hour have an incentive to bill a lot of hours, consciously or unconsciously. "I want them to be completely aligned with me," Boswell says. Pressure from corporate legal departments has intensified since the recession, as they themselves come under greater pressure each year during budget season. Not wanting to lose out on business, law firms have become more accommodating when clients ask for fixed fees. "We don't want to be in the position of saying, 'Sorry, we don't have what you're looking for,'" says John Paris, a partner at Williams Mullen APC, who is in charge of a new efficiency push at the firm. "We're trying to get out ahead of it," he says. Partners at several Triangle law firms express similar thinking. Large companies such as SAS use fixed cost arrangements most often, according to annual surveys of corporate legal departments by Fulbright and Jaworski LLP, an international law firm. About 62% of companies Fulbright surveyed in 2011 were paying via alternative billing in some instances, up from 52% in 2010 and 48% in 2009. GlaxoSmithKline, the British drug giant whose U.S. headquarters is in Research Triangle Park, spent 63% of its outside legal budget under alternative fee arrangements in 2011, up from less than 3% in 2007. GSK Associate General Counsel Bob Harcutt says, "Alternative billing has taken hold even in litigation, a notoriously unpredictable practice area, says Camden Webb, a financial services litigator in Williams Mullen Raleigh office. A common approach to address the uncertainty of an eventual trial is to use fixed fees in early phases, Webb and others say. A client might pay a certain amount for each witness deposed or each motion filed, for example, and even flat fee arrangements typically allow for extra fees when a case takes an unforeseen turn. Additionally, some firms agree to accept lower base fees for litigation, but with bonus payments if they win a favorable settlement or a judgment, says Tom Kane, a former practicing attorney in High Point who advises law firms on business development and billing. Fixed fees have become prevalent in several areas of law, including contracts, employment law, and even mergers and acquisitions. SAS negotiated a single flat fee for outside counsel to handle the company's acquisition of Raleigh's AI match this month, Boswell says. Since 2010, the RTP-based clinical research firm Quintiles has been assigning all employment defense litigation to Raleigh's Smith Anderson LLP and two other firms under flat fees, General Counsel John Goodacre says. Still, it's not all litigation is conducive to flat fees. In-house and outside attorneys caution. There's the bet-the-company litigation where you'll spend anything, Boswell says, but that's not everything. Next up, Home of the Rich, Local Metro's Lead State in Affluence, by Lauren K. Onsorge, from Raleigh. Raleigh and its surrounding area has the greatest concentration of high earners in North Carolina and the 52nd most in the nation, according to an analysis of U.S. Census data. Just over 5% of the 407,000 households in the three-county area of Wake, Johnston, and Franklin counties had incomes of more than $200,000, followed by the Durham-Chapel Hill area with 4.7% of its 196,000 households listed as high earners. The data was analyzed by researchers with American City Business Journals, the parent company of Triangle Business Journal. This is a very highly educated workforce, NC State University economist Steve Allen says. There is such a strong correlation with earnings and education with a huge percentage of people with advanced degrees in this area. Education, he says, directly contributes to earnings. Census numbers compiled by the Chronicle of Higher Education for 2005 through 2009 back up his view. In Raleigh, 47.5% of the workforce was reported to be college graduates, as was 43.9% of Durham's workforce. Compare that to 40.48% in Mecklenburg County. Its metro area, which includes Charlotte, Gaston County, and suburbs in South Carolina, was home to the state's third highest percentage of high earners, according to the ACBJ data, with 4.6% of its households earning more than $200,000. The Raleigh market is more varied, with higher concentrations of biotechnology and life sciences jobs than in the Mecklenburg Metro, a banking center that took a major hit during the 2008 financial services crisis. Census numbers for 2010 reveal there were 3,157 jobs in the pharmaceutical and medical manufacturing industry in Raleigh alone, with 6,771 in Durham and only 339 in Charlotte. Had the recession targeted biotechnology instead of banking and finance, Allen says, the impact would have been more severe in the Triangle than it was. A lot of Charlotte's high-earning jobs were with a limited number of companies in banking, Allen says. If, on down the road, there were significant cutbacks on federal research dollars, that would have had a big effect on this market. Henry Oman III, with accounting firm Grant Thornton, says that despite their affluence, high earners are tending towards frugality due to the state of the economy. Tom Anhut, with upscale residential developer Toll Builders, is seeing this caution reflected in home sales. While sales of new and existing homes for price points above $500,000 are up by 7% over last year, he calls that gain minute. Sales have been soft, says Anhut. Sammy Thompson, 30-year salesman at Varsity Menswear in North Hills, is seeing something similar in retail. Just because there are high earners doesn't mean they're high spenders. In this economy, you can't look for big-time increases, he says. It's a gradual thing. His store is starting to see gradual increases, but full recovery from the recession will take time. It's coming, he says. People are looking for value. They're not spending too much, but they will. The following article is titled ECB Looks for New Financing After Agreement Falls Through, by Lee Weisbecker, from Raleigh. East Carolina Bank will get at least until June 30th to work out the financing for its planned Triangle expansion. The plan hit a snag when the Engelhard-based Community Bank recently announced that the deal it needed to finance the Triangle move had been terminated. ECB was planning to sell around 4.7 million shares of its own common stock to five investors, including an affiliate of California bond giant PIMCO for $80 million. With that cash in hand, ECB intended to buy four former Gateway Bank branches in the Triangle, plus some undeveloped parcels of land from Gateway's Virginia owner, the Bank of Hampton Roads. Along with the branches would come $200 million in deposits, but no loans. Without commenting on developments at ECB, Hampton Roads Executives Vice President Stephen Theobald says the Virginia Bank has agreed to the June deadline extension on the branch sale, adding, "We're still expecting that this will close." Whether, in fact, that happens will depend on ECB's success in breathing new life into its old fundraising deal, which was terminated by both parties, or crafting a new one. Analyst Brady Galley, who covers ECB for Keefe, Briette, and Woods, says he believes the bank will attempt to renegotiate the old package with PIMCO. Other key investors include Patriot Financial of Philadelphia and New York-based Endicott Management. But any new terms, he adds, won't be as favorable as before. Under the terminated deal, which was based on an ECB stock price of $16 per share, the Coastal Bank was putting roughly 69% of itself on the block. Presuming renegotiations at the current trading price of $10, Galley says raising the same target amount would require ECB to put up about 74% of itself on the block. "We believe that without the completion of this private capital raise, the branch acquisition will most likely be terminated as well," he adds. In addition to buying the Triangle branches, ECB had planned to use a portion of the $80 million to pay off $18 million it owes the U.S. Treasury for an infusion from the Troubled Asset Relief Program, or TARP. ECB CEO Dwight Utz declined to comment for this article. Next up, transplanted company boosts revenues and workers in Garner enjoy it. Vistech leaders call on the cloud to transmit images such as CT scans to health professionals. By Jason DeBrun from Garner. At the intersection of medicine and technology, a new way to read and store images could save a lot of money. And a company that moved its headquarters from Florida to Garner intends to be in the middle of the action, even though it means competing against the likes of giants Fujifilm and Siemens. The company, Vistech, now has 100 employees and $50 million in revenue. That's up from 30 employees and $30 million in revenue in 2008, just before it relocated to the Triangle. "We're putting images everywhere," says Steve Deaton, Vistech Vice President of Sales. "It doesn't matter what device you're on." Images such as x-rays, CT scans, or mammograms can come with a price tag well into the four-digit range. Yet even today, many of those images are stored digitally on a compact disc and mailed so that a radiologist or a physician can read them at the office. Now, cloud-based technology such as that at Vistech promises to cut down on duplication and give physicians wider and more immediate access to their patients' records. The cloud acts as a giant server accessible through the Internet. If a radiologist uploads a file to the cloud from one office, it is accessible from anywhere that has access to the cloud, basically anywhere that has Internet access. This could speed up the process and reduce redundancies of taking an image twice, not only saving money but also lowering radiation exposure to patients. "Anything we can do to improve access for patients or physicians is a good thing," says Dr. Holly Carpenter, Director for Radiology at the WakeMed Health and Hospitals Raleigh campus. John Strict, Director of the Internet 2 Technology Evaluation Center at NC State University, says he and some fellow computer science professors spend a lot of time thinking about how to make medical technology better. He predicts that in a few years, medical data storage and usage will look drastically different than it does now, and physicians will become more interconnected on a secure platform. Those in healthcare say that the industry can be slow to adapt. Carpenter says her office still receives many requests for images on CDs and thinks Strick's forecast of only a few years is optimistic. But they do see changes coming. "Cloud sharing is a big buzzword right now," says Dr. Tom Hasley, the head of Diagnostic Services at Rex Healthcare, adding that applications to read images on a tablet computer might not be far off. Radiology practices require a PACS, picture archiving and communication system, to read images, but they are expensive and need regular updates. PACS manufacturers, like Vistek, now upload the entire system to the cloud, which allows a doctor to manipulate an image from any computer. To be sure, other PACS manufacturers do the same. WakeMed, for example, uses a system by Merge Healthcare based in Chicago, but Vistek has installed about 5,000 systems nationwide and targets networks of practices, not necessarily large hospital systems. Instead of a large sales force, it partners with X-ray servicing companies such as Mary X-ray to get the word out. Dr. John Fiel, CEO of Strategic Imaging Consultants in Chapel Hill, says he has been happy with Vistek's technology. Groups such as Fiel's are a good target for Vistek because their professionals read images from medical facilities such as urgent care or private practices that don't have a radiologist on staff, but don't run the volume of a large hospital system that takes images 24 hours a day. With the cloud-based technology, Fiel can read an image taken anywhere in the world and give an immediate report. In previous years, he would have had to have waited for a CD to be delivered. Next up, It's a Long Road, but Raleigh Code Revisions Gaining Focus, by Amanda Jones Hoyle, from Raleigh. A draft of a revised zoning and development code book for the city of Raleigh is facing a stream of questions from business leaders and property owners concerned that the new rules could be more restrictive than the old ones. If some of these rules were to be adopted, a car garage in a new single-family household could not be aligned with the front door of the property, or a new office building must have 60% of the front as a glass structure with much of the inside visible from street level. The city's Unified Development Ordinance, or UDO, which dictates how every property owner within the city limits can build, develop, or redevelop their land and buildings, is undergoing its first major rewrite in more than 30 years. While most developers, real estate lawyers, architects, and engineers agree that an update is needed, the devil has been in the details, says Lacey Reeves, a real estate lawyer with Smith Anderson. Its adoption is most significant change in the city's regulation of real estate development I've ever seen in almost 40 years I've been practicing law in Raleigh, says Reeves. Every parcel of land in the city's jurisdiction will be affected. Details of the latest draft were scrutinized at a February 21st public hearing. Mitchell Silver, Chief Planning and Development Officer with Raleigh, says the proposed UDO changes would offer more flexibility than the city's older method of zoning, while still setting standards for future development and protecting existing neighborhoods. One of the major changes would allow approval of some site plans by staff members of the Raleigh Planning Department rather than by the Planning Commission or City Council. Reeves says some are concerned because of the role of elected officials is eliminated. Others support the concept of administrative approval as long as the standards for approval are entirely objective. Some of the standards are subjective in the current draft of the UDO, he says. Silver says the switch would take some getting used to. But if you follow the rules, you can get your approvals administratively, and that can save a developer months and months in the approval process, Silver says. If you deviate from the rules, it becomes discretionary and will still go to City Council. The revised code would place restrictions on many architectural and site design elements for future residential, commercial, and mixed-use buildings. Store designs of some national retailers, for example, would not fit within the regulations. Another concern of some business owners is how the new UDO would make their business a non-conforming use under the code's new zoning district. The code does grandfather in all existing buildings, but for many business types, including car washes and check cashing businesses, improvement to a property could be impeded in the event of a fire or other casualty. A non-conforming status also affects the ability to refinance, Reeves notes. Wes Carroll, president of Upright Builders in Cary and past president of the Home Builders Association of Raleigh-Wake County, says it's pretty far-reaching, impacting everything and everybody. The journalist Amanda Jones Hoyle writes an addendum to this article. There's no rush to get the new code in place, says Silver. The proposed Unified Development Ordinance has been referred to the Raleigh Planning Commission, which has 105 days to review the document. If needed, the commission can request more time, and they probably will, says Mitchell Silver, Chief Planning and Development Officer for Raleigh. The Planning Commission plans to hold public meetings throughout the spring to go chapter by chapter through the code. After it is approved, the City Council will have a chance to review the UDO. There's no rush to get through this, and there is no timeline, Silver says. I hope the City Council will get this by early June, but that's entirely up to the Planning Commission. After the UDO is approved by the City Council, Silver estimates it would be another 3 to 6 months before the changes are implemented. Next up, Wake Med signs on for 3 more years at soccer complex. By Jason DeBruin from Cary. After a bit of technical back and forth, the soccer complex in Cary will carry the Wake Med Health and Hospitals name for 3 additional years, and, by at least one estimate, the hospital system got a good deal. Wake Med will pay $315,000 annually for 3 years, which brings it naming and various advertising rights. It's a logical fit for us, says Deb Lowry, Wake Med Vice President of Public Relations. That whole complex is about health. That's why our name is on it. The previous contract expired on December 31, 2011, but the new contract wasn't hashed out until this week. The new contract, which will be effective retroactive to January 1st, is expected to gain approval from Cary Town Council. The delay in signing a new agreement was due to a provision in the old contract that gave Wake Med various advertising rights during games played by the Carolina Railhawks, a North American Soccer League team that plays its home games at the complex. Since Wake Med and the Railhawks have agreements with the town, the council did not want to be in the middle of matters relating only to Railhawks and Wake Med and stripped the contract of the provision. Wake Med and the Railhawks still have an understanding that the soccer team will promote the hospital at various times during games, as well as provide promotions on its website and some stadium banners, Lowry says. While discussions took more turns than a David Beckham corner kick, it now appears Wake Med is intent on staying on as a long-term partner. William Davis, the town of Cary's athletics program manager, says other companies wanted in on the naming rights deal, though he wouldn't name any, but Wake Med came with the best offer. SAS Institute held naming rights for the park before a 3-year deal was signed with Wake Med in 2008 for $300,000 a year. In 2011, the two parties renewed the deal for 1 year at $125,000 because the future of the Railhawks was in flux. For their part, the Railhawks pay the town $90,000 per year to play 16 home games at the stadium. By one estimate, Cary left some money on the table in the Wake Med deal. The town will invest up to $5 million in stadium improvements, increasing seating capacity and adding VIP areas. Wake Med increased its sponsorship by only 5%, but the stadium will increase its capacity by some 42%. With this being a renewable contract of only 3 years, logically the naming rights should better keep pace with what's being done to take the venue to the next level, says Hill Caro, CEO of Sports and Properties, a sports and entertainment consultancy in Cary. The town hopes the upgrades will again make the soccer complex a destination for the College Cup, NCAA Soccer Championship weekend. Cary hosted either the men's or the women's tournaments every year from 2003 through 2010, but lost the bid when it didn't make some renovations requested by the National Collegiate Athletic Association. With the renovations, Davis hopes the NCAA will again look to the soccer complex, which the ACC has chosen several times to host its league championship tournament. The annual cost of operating the complex has been increased from $1.1 million to $1.57 million, with the increase due to renovations to fields 2 and 3. And now, New State CIO Aims to Find Efficiencies in IT Backbone by Lauren K. Assange from Raleigh. Bringing efficiency to the state's massive information technology infrastructure, which cost the state $1.38 billion in fiscal 2011, is the goal of North Carolina's new Chief Information Officer. Called the Consolidator by State Budget Director Andy Willis, Jonathan Wermer aims to take a hard look at ITS over the next year and balance cost concerns with technological needs. There are core pieces of infrastructure that need to be rock solid, he says, mentioning applications such as email that are vital to day-to-day operations. If you've got a set amount of money, it's really key to focus on where you'll get the biggest bang for the buck. Willis says it's that focus that has helped Wermer become indispensable as Deputy Director for Management at the Office of State Budget and Management. He actually does the work, Willis says. In our office, he was the brain trust of the governor's consolidation plan for state government, especially with the Department of Public Safety. Wermer says he'll continue consolidations that followed a 2010 audit of the North Carolina Department of Administration. That report concluded that the department had failed to ensure that agencies were following purchasing requirements and resulted in a plan by Governor Beverly Perdue to consolidate 13 state agencies into 8. Wermer was particularly active in Department of Public Safety consolidations, saving more than $3 million, Willis said. Exiting CIO Jerry Frelick in office since September of 2009 released a statement to the agency staff at ITS. After several years of much success in continuing consolidation, reducing ITS expenditures, and working with the vendor community, I am moving on to pursue other opportunities, he wrote. Besides managing existing technology, the CIO also has authority over IT project approval and oversight, procurement, security, planning, and budgeting. CIO responsibilities are supported by the Information Technology Fund. The CIO also leads the Office of Information Technology Services, which supplies some of the IT used by state agencies, local governments, and educational institutions across North Carolina. And now it's time for A Better World. News about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activities. From the Philanthropy News Desk of Todd Cohen, Boys and Girls Clubs, Target Outcomes. In Wake County, 402 teenage girls got pregnant in 2010. That same year, none of the teen girls who are members of the Boys and Girls Clubs of Wake County became pregnant. To support its efforts to help youngsters improve their academic performance and health, the Boys and Girls Clubs have launched their annual fundraising drive. Co-chaired by Jeff Linder, a lawyer at Young, Moore, and Henderson, and by Dominion Brew, and a lawyer at Blue Stevens and Fellers, the drive this year aims to raise $1.4 million, the organization's biggest goal ever, up from $1.24 million it raised last year. The Boys and Girls Clubs are also in the quiet phase of a capital campaign to raise $12 million, an effort that already has raised more than $6 million, says Alan Taylor, who joined the organization in November after serving as director of university campaigns for United Way of North Carolina. Operating with an annual budget of $3 million and a staff of 23 people working full-time and 37 working part-time, the Boys and Girls Clubs served more than 4,200 members in the fiscal year ended June 30, 2011, at 7 clubs and a summer day camp in Nash County. Funds from the capital campaign are being used to build a new facility in Zebulon, a new teen center on Raleigh Boulevard in Raleigh, and renovations to the camp and other facilities. Aiming to help the Boys and Girls Club serve another 2,000 children a year within 10 years, the campaign is co-chaired by Prentice Baker III, chairman of Baker Roofing, Michael Dickinson, vice president for wealth management at Morgan Stanley Smith Barney, and community volunteer Noel Lichten. A local foundation that wishes to remain anonymous has agreed to match up to $100,000 that the campaign raises in new and increased dollars, including $75,000 from any source and $25,000 online. Last year's campaign raised $120,000 online alone, up from $50,000 the previous year. The new Zebulon Boys and Girls Club, which opened in January and cost $2.5 million, will serve 1,000 kids, replacing a trailer that served 400 kids. The new Teen Center, with construction not expected to begin this year, will serve 500 kids and house the organization's administrative offices that are now located at the Girls Club next door. Funds from the campaign will also be used to renovate buildings, buy new vehicles, provide startup funds to support programs in low-income areas the clubs do not yet serve, and increase the club's endowment to $5.5 million from $2.5 million. The Wake Clubs are also piloting a new initiative launched in 2011 by Boys and Girls Clubs of America that aims to do a better job tracking the outcomes of programs it offers. By targeting programs to young people who need us the most, Taylor says, and helping them attend those programs on a regular basis, the clubs will deliver better outcomes to members in the areas of academic success, character and citizenship, and healthy lifestyles. And now from the opinion page. This article is titled Soaring Vision from Delta's Anderson. The prologue says, if Richard Anderson is worried about Southwest Airlines entering the Atlanta market, he doesn't show it. Anderson, CEO of Delta Airlines Incorporated, sat down for an extensive conversation with Maria Saporta of Triangle Business Journal's sister paper, Atlanta Business Chronicle, 2 days before Southwest's inaugural February 12th flight into Hartsfield-Jackson Atlanta International Airport. Also of local interest is the fact that Anderson's rise to the Delta CEO slot resulted in the departure of the carrier's COO, Jim Whitehurst. Whitehurst soon became the CEO of Red Hat in Raleigh. Here is an excerpt of that conversation. About the only question Anderson would not answer was whether Delta has any interest in acquiring American Airlines or U.S. Airways, possibilities that have been featured in the national media. Still, there is little doubt Anderson is basking in the financial success that Delta has enjoyed in the last couple of years, a stark contrast from when he went from being just a Delta board member to becoming CEO on September 1, 2007, to help the airline emerge from bankruptcy. If you look at what we have accomplished, given where we were in 2006, we now have the highest margins in the industry. We've paid down $4.5 billion in debt. We've had 2 strong years of profitability, and we are headed into another year of strong profitability, Anderson said. Our people have accomplished a lot. When asked about Southwest entering Delta's hometown, Anderson acknowledged that Southwest is a strong competitor, and that CEO Gary Kelly is a capable leader of Southwest. But he quickly added that Delta successfully competed against AirTran Airways before its merger with Southwest, and that Southwest's model is quite different from Delta's. We have very different business strategies, Anderson said. Delta has first class. Delta has Sky Clubs. Delta has assigned seating. Delta has first checked bag-free with an American Express card, and we have a very large footprint. In fact, Anderson repeatedly mentioned the synergies between Delta and Atlanta and how vital they are to the region's economy. Asked whether fares will go up on flights to cities that have been served by AirTran but will not be served by Southwest, Anderson shook his head. It will be as competitive as it's always been, he said. Our prices are set by a very competitive marketplace. Anderson said that Delta had to reprogram some of our sponsorship dollars to the community so it could donate to Grady and the National Center for Civil and Human Rights, as well as support the city's efforts for pension and financial reform. As an aside, Anderson said that the community absolutely should save the cyclorama, which has fallen into disrepair. Anderson also would like for the Metro Atlanta Chamber and economic development organizations to study the most business-friendly policy for corporate headquarters, banking, malpractice insurance, labor issues, or credit card processing that exist in the country. I would like to go around and find the best legal structures for businesses in all 50 states, and then do an omnibus package of legal reforms, Anderson said. As for Delta's investment strategy, Anderson has his eye on Latin America. Delta already has taken a stake in Aeromexico and a stake in the Gol airline in Brazil. We have to have Spanish signage in the airport, We need to Latinize Hartsfield-Jackson. This can be a big gateway to Mexico and Latin America, Anderson says, adding that he has been and continues to be an outspoken critic of Georgia's restrictive immigration law. Anderson, who has a copy of Strunk and White's Elements of Style on his desk for easy reference, then highlighted his top priority. The most important thing for us at Delta is to preserve the culture, said Anderson, crediting former CEO Gerald Grinstein for doing a remarkable job reestablishing the culture of the airline. Next up, Editor's Notebook by Sugata Mukherjee. Where sports and business match. What does a professional sports franchise teach us about leadership and motivation? In most cases, really not much. As the sports business has mushroomed into a multi-billion dollar business with players making tens of millions of dollars a year, the role of managers and coaches so often is determined by the performances of a team's star horse. If she or he does not perform, a manager or coach is often fired. One recent example can be found in the firing of Carolina Hurricanes head coach Paul Maurice after the team's key players, such as Captain Eric Staal and goaltender Cam Ward, were no-shows during much of the front part of the season. These kind of examples are sprinkled across all sports, football, basketball, baseball, and hockey, as fans and sponsors expect their teams to perform well if players are getting gobs of money. But every team cannot win. There will be winners and losers, just like in business. And therein lies the real strength of a coach or a manager. Let's take the new Hurricanes coach, Kirk Muller, as an example. Team general manager Jim Rutherford is coming out as a genius for making the call on Muller. The team is amid its best run of the season by winning games at home and staying competitive on the road. The club's biggest superstar, Staal, is on fire. He once again is scoring goals, dishing out assists, and defending slap shots with his legs in front of his own goal. So it was Muller that prompted this change in production, was it? Staal is on record stating that having Muller in the locker room freshened things up, and that has helped. Muller has said that the team is performing well because its star player is leading the team with positivity, optimism, and confidence. Now transpose that scenario onto a business that recently has seen a change at the helm, say the CEO. If you are part of the management team, or say the CEO, have you seen changes in the way the management team has been performing since the new sheriff was appointed? Professor Alan Lind at Duke University says there is research that shows that when a new leader arrives, workers internally undergo a sense of observe and absorb attitude until trust and the confidence is established. For a leader, that's a tough period because he or she is not equipped with the tools and the trust from the employees to take the company to the next level. And that's why leaders need to make their strengths clear to constituents. They cannot know everything. Nobody knows everything, Lynn says. They must be good at a few things. And that's what they should focus on in the initial stages. When they get some early victories, it can often smoothen the path. Lind argues that it has become more difficult for a leader today to notch victories because of competition, lower patience levels from boards, shareholders, and employees, and economic headwinds. The good ones are getting paid more than ever, but there's also a much wider churn at the top, according to statistics compiled by outplacement company Challenger, Gray, and Christmas. Last month alone, 123 CEOs lost or left their jobs. That was the highest monthly total since 2010. But just as with what Muller is experiencing with his team's success, changes at the top of a corporation often show similar results. A study done by researchers at the University of Manchester in the UK showed sales and profit margins went up dramatically at companies that changed leaders who eventually gained the trust and confidence of the employee base. So Mueller's success is far from an aberration. The larger question is performance long term, and how does one sustain positive momentum for future years? The University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill has put out definitions of what constitutes sexual harassment, prompting an organization for free speech to retort that the university is infringing on its students' First Amendment rights. On the Dean of Students webpage, UNCCH gives examples of sexual harassment including explicit or implicit propositions to engage in sexual activity, as well as comments of a sexual nature, including sexually explicit jokes or anecdotes, whistling, ogling, barking, or leering, and remarks of sexual nature regarding a person's clothing or body. The Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, or FIRE, says the university is chilling expressive activity on UNC's campus and hopes to draw enough attention to the policy so the dean's office will take down some of the definitions of sexual harassment. This is unbelievable. By clipping coupons and carefully using the system to full advantage, a Cary 7th grader spent just under $20 and got more than 1,400 pounds of food that he donated to Western Wake Crisis Ministry in Apex. It was a work of Chris Inholson and his family, who took the coupon clipping as a challenge. By using double coupons and other tactics, most of the food collected ended up being free, according to a report at CaryCitizen.com. The only cost? $19.80 for 20 boxes of popcorn. Hey, Chris, would you like to go shopping with the Triangle Business Journal? Boy, does this guy get around. American Idol Scotty McCreery will perform during the annual North Carolina Azalea Festival on April 13th in Wilmington. Scotty's show will be at 8 p.m. in Trask Coliseum, with tickets going for $52.50 or $62.50. In the meantime, he's driving his new truck around Garner, where he's finishing high school and getting ready to pitch for the baseball team. It's the 65th edition of the Azalea Festival, which runs April 11th through the 15th this year. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This episode of the Triangle Business Journal will be available for download from the TRRS website momentarily. The web address is triangleReadingService.org. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.